Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Ashkan Kazarian. HUI is the system used for querying databases of information on domain name, registrations, and IP addresses, has been a vital tool for journalists and security researchers and law enforcement in identifying and tracking spammers, phishers, identity thieves, and other cybercriminals. However, when the EU's General Data Protection Regulation takes effect on May 25th, the service will heavily be limited or possibly shut down completely in order to comply with privacy requirements. How will this impact cybersecurity? Does HUI's raise legitimate privacy concerns? We're joined by Shane Tews, president of Logan Circle Strategies and visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Tim Chen, CEO of Domain Tools, to discuss. Thank you for joining me, Shane, Tim.
Thank you for having us.
First off, what is HUI's?
So the WHOIS is a very old protocol from internet years. It started in the mid-80s. A little strange fact is at one point, actually, AT&T ran the WHOIS, but couldn't find any reason to make money on it because no one was really on the internet yet. And so they put it back. And the then Network Solutions, now VeriSign, who run the .com, .net, then .org, started to administer it. What the WHOIS has in it is two key pieces of information, the administrative contact and the technical contact. And the legacy reason for that was the administrative contact was how you got paid. So if they didn't pay for their leasing their domain name, you knew to contact. And the second piece was basically if your computer was causing problems, they knew who to bring the IP number back to. So it's been like that for a long time. There have been numerous times where people wanted to change it, but there are throughout the years, and it has really been law enforcement and government. And since then, you know, companies that have seen the opportunities of using it as a tool to secure things on the internet, it has a very long following. So the idea of changing the WHOIS because of a change in the European data protection laws is very challenging to the entire ecosystem of the internet.
Tim, in a WHOIS lookup, registrars must collect and display a range of information. What kind of information, aside from what Shane mentioned, is in there?
Sure. So domain registration, at least in the GTLD space, is really a combination of two basic data sets. On one hand, you have the personal data of the individual normally that's registering the domain name, and then that's combined with information about the registration itself. So for example, on the personal side, you'll have the registrant's name, registrant's email, phone number, and mailing address, which includes the country. And then when I say registration information, what I mean are things like who is the registrar? What was the date on which the domain was registered? When does it expire? What are the name servers that are used to resolve the domain name in DNS and a few other factors like that? So it's really a combination of those two data sets that together create a WHOIS record in the domain name space.
And most registrars, they withhold some of this information from public lookups, either for a fee or it's free for its consumers. Is that correct?
It's free. So in, again, the generic TLD space is separate from the country code space. So when I say generic TLD, I'm talking about the top-level domains, so right of the dot, that are under ICANN's purview. Things like .uk in the United Kingdom, .cn in China, .de in Germany are sovereign to those nations. But for .com and .net and all of these new GTLDs that people may have seen out there, it's under ICANN's purview. And ICANN has a requirement in its contracts where it accredits registrars to have the right...
Sorry, I'm going to stop you right there. For our listeners who don't know what ICANN is, do you mind elaborating?
Sure. ICANN is the International Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers.
The Internet Corporation on Assigned Names.
Thank you. The Internet Corporation on the Assigned Names and Numbers. And basically, they're responsible for making policy on the internet, to kind of summarize it. And you could have your own podcast on ICANN and how it's changing. But I'll just say that part of what they do in administering domain names and IP address space is they require a registrar, if they want to commercially offer domain names for sale, such as GoDaddy does, as a well-known one. And by the way, there's over 1,000 of these out there in the world. One of the things that they have to sign up for in their written contracts is to provide the WHOIS data, the registrant data, publicly and make it publicly available for free.
And I think it's worth taking a step back on how ICANN, they were created when the Department of Commerce under then President Clinton wanted to figure out how we could commercialize this space that originally it was a DARPA project that then went to the National Science Foundation. And then it became interesting to people. And so more and more people started signing up for it. And candidly, for us Washington types, the National Science Foundation didn't want to use their appropriated funds for this new project. And so they put out an 8A contract that became Network Solutions. And they being the Department of Commerce, did a green paper that became the white paper, which eventually became ICANN. And the key part of that was this creation of the multi-stakeholder process. So you have constituencies that are for the intellectual property constituency. You have now we have brands, which is recent. And the trademark holders have been there the whole time. There are the registries and the registrars, which Tim has mentioned, as well as the government advisory committee. What makes ICANN unique from a government perspective is that the governments do not have a larger say in what's going to happen than anybody else in the multi-stakeholder process. So it is unlike the UN or unlike the International Telecommunications Union. They are allowed to have an opinion and voice it and tell ICANN's board, but they don't have any sort of, you know, putting the lever down on the commercial side, or the civil society is also very engaged.
And we have a few very highly opinionated pieces that our president has put on ICANN that are going to link in the show notes, too. So it sounds like ICANN is this gatekeeper of sorts. And Shane, you mentioned the EU privacy regulations, and I know I talked about them in the intro. They're about to drop. How is this going to conflict with WHOIS, and what's going to happen? What are you expecting to happen?
So when we think about privacy, we have to realize that Europeans manage privacy and their view of privacy rights very differently than we do in the United States. The way I describe it is that in the United States, we look at it in verticals, in almost industry verticals. So we have like Graham Leach Bliley has privacy rights around it. We have HIPAA, which has healthcare privacy around it. There are, you know, several things in the banking industry beyond Graham Leach Bliley. Consumer issues, which are then under the Federal Trade Commission, but again, very vertical silos. And it's about why are you collecting the information, not the way the Europeans look at it, which I consider horizontal, which is they think about you as the individual, which is where we're getting into this challenge with the WHOIS, is that the natural person, which is you as an individual, have privacy rights across the board, not looking at them from the perspective of why are they collecting the information. We, as Tim was describing how the WHOIS information is collected, we've never differentiated between a person as an entity and a business as an entity. So that sounds simple when you first hear it, but it's a very complex process to go back through because our laws do not mesh, you know, parallel in the way that the Europeans look at this, and not only Americans, but, you know, Asians and other countries. It's a new issue, the way that this general data protection right is wanting to allow individuals to take things offline, have the right to be forgotten, just things that the internet was not built to do.
Tim, so how do you think it's going to clash with EU privacy regulations? Because as far as I understand, ICANN has requested forbearance on these rules and they were denied. So what's going to happen with WHOIS?
I wish I could tell you exactly, but I think we're going to find out very soon. That's all correct. So clearly, with the GDPR, with the requirement to treat personal data with more care than perhaps has been treated in the past, does conflict with a regulation in the contract that requires a registrar to publish all of this data. So I think that's pretty clear. And I think the challenge is, how do you get through that and still protect what the true spirit of WHOIS was to begin with? Because I don't believe it is the spirit of GDPR or the policy and lawmakers behind the GDPR to try and increase security risk on the internet as an outcome of their law. I think my guess is they were targeting some very purposeful misuse of this data, and I think the law will be very effective, hopefully, in rectifying that. I think the challenge is that as you think through how this law is affecting certain other systems or constituencies, of which WHOIS is one, and you bring in experts in that space who use the data in a certain way, and I think a very positive way, you start to realize that it's going to have some unintended consequences. And I think that's really what our perspective is. Our perspective is it really does matter the security of individual internet users and how the WHOIS data is used in that respect. It does matter how this data is used to protect everything from the nation state on down. All security vendors and organizations doing network security for their own organizations and users. Many of those organizations are users of this data. I can say that because our company, which uses this data set to create security tools, we have over 500 enterprise customers, which includes over a third of the Fortune 100. It includes over 100 customers over in Europe. We have a number of U.S. Government agencies that are customers, as well as security teams and computer emergency response teams in Europe, which are all, I think, on our side on this issue. And so when you get to talk to security practitioners, you realize that they're not anti-privacy, but they are pro-security. And a number of us feel like there needs to be a rebalancing of that as this law intersects a part of the internet that I think it wasn't meant to affect and actually destroys privacy and security for individuals when taken to the extreme of turning off all the personal data and who is.
You already touched upon that in your answer, but can you elaborate a little bit more on personal example, how this clash will affect your business and security in general for security researchers and maybe law enforcement to identify scammers or identity thieves or to help fight cyber criminals? What are the kind of day-to-day cyber threats that are going to become more dangerous because of this?
Sure. I'll take that in two pieces. I'll talk about enterprise security, and then I'll talk about how it intersects internet users like you and I. So on the enterprise side, the enterprise security teams use lots of different data to do the jobs, lots of different tools. There's no magic ultimate security weapon that they use to try and protect their networks and their IP and their users and their employees. What our data does is it allows organizations to do two things historically that they've been really important in incident response. One is when you have an indication that something is amiss on your network, you get an alert in one of your security systems that says someone may have clicked on a domain they shouldn't have, one of our employees perhaps. We see something on network that looks anomalous. All cyber attacks, almost by definition, transit the internet, right? So they use the domain and IP space to provision the attack, and therefore there's fingerprints and footprints and evidence of what happens in that process. And the Whois data is one of the data sets that could be used to figure out who it is that's provisioning this attack, and incredibly importantly, what other internet resources they own or control. And the reason that's important is because bad actors are often not just using one domain name in their attack. They're often provisioning often tens of thousands for the more sophisticated attackers. If you see one anomaly, one alert, you can take the Whois data from that domain name and you can map other domains that can be associated with it through Whois data. That allows you to say all these other domains are also associated with this one. I'm going to block all those at the edge of my network now to prevent any more badness. And I also can take those artifacts from these other domain names and go hunting for them on my network to see if there's other things that I haven't found yet that are already compromised on my network. That's very important from an enterprise security standpoint. I also want to add that more recently, one of the real values of Whois data is Domain Tools has a machine learning team, and I know that's an often used buzzword, but we've been actually doing this for 2 years without even talking about it. And our team has set up classifiers trained on malicious domains and IP addresses and then applied that to all new domains that get registered. So as we see new domains that get registered, we can score them as likely to be bad or unlikely to be bad. And that gets to predicting bad behavior ahead of time, which is really where security needs to go, because it's much more valuable to prevent attacks than to have to remediate them well after the fact when damage has already been done. So the data is also useful in kind of a predictive and preventative look forward way. The issue intersects consumers like you and me in this way. Everyone runs email, whether it's Gmail or through Office 365 or some other email platform. They have built-in security, built-in spam protection. You just get it for free when you use your Gmail address. You're trusting that Google is going to understand what's spam and what's not. They do a very, very good job, by the way. They're relying on a lot of data to run real-time algorithms to understand if they should allow or disallow that email into your inbox. The same thing happens in browsers. So browsers, whether you use Chrome or IE or Firefox, whatever you choose to use, they are building security into the browser layer. So they'll notify you, and you may have seen this in some of your internet browsing. You're trying to navigate to a website or a web page. We think this may be a compromised site or maybe doing some things that some malicious things. Double check that this is really where you want to go and click here to prove you want to go to this website. And that's built-in security at the browser layer. That kind of security and filtering is dependent on an awful lot of different data to try and make that decision at real time. And one of the data sets that they use is Whois data. So that's an example of if you retract this data, you're weakening those filters in a certain way. That's a very tangible example of how the world could get a little bit more dangerous if this data goes away.
And the Whois or the domain names tend to be the on-ramp for the internet. So you have to start at some point, and it really is where a lot of this starts, which is why we go back to the who is and ICANN's role being very important in this.
You bring up a lot of very terrifying examples of a potential future. I want to voice some of the opinions that critics have voiced, that critics have said about who is. So they argue that who is provides too much personal information publicly that can be used by the cyber criminals you were just talking about. Is there any merit to that criticism, Shane? What do you think?
So for years, there has been a thought that we put a layering process into the who is and do an authentication. The reason why law enforcement are challenged by that is that unlike the analog world where you are surrounding a house or you're going to a building where a crime has been committed, things move very quickly on the internet. So they've been technically challenged to figure out how can they get access as quick as they need. You know, law firms will want that information for trademark reasons or intellectual property or you know, damage to a client. They don't need quite the speed, even though speed's very important to them as well. So the authentication process, it has been worked on in ICANN for the last 20 years. They have really ramped it up recently. This current challenge with GDPR has put a stop or a hold on that, even though because they're trying to decide, you know, if you're going to spend a lot of time, money, and energy, where should they be putting it? And right now, no one's quite sure. Dialogue that's been going on with the data protection people in Europe, they have been thinking about this. So it's an acknowledgement that the Whois was not designed with privacy in mind, and we're trying to find a structure that works for everyone. But completely breaking it for the current situation is not the answer.
I know I keep hammering and asking you what's going to happen, and I'm going to do it one more time. So what are the long-term prospects? Is it likely that ICANN will find a way to make Whois comply with GDPR on time for before May 25th, or maybe they're going to get an extension after all? I don't know. Or will it be replaced by some other system or nothing at all, and we're just going to have to live in this brand new world, which... honestly, I always keep saying it's not going to happen. In the last 2 years, so many things have gone through that I've stopped saying that.
So a couple of thoughts for you on that. One is that this is an expense to registrars, which are the retail end where the consumer or the institution or enterprise is able to lease their domain name. So the idea that they could stop gathering this information actually... for some of them, they think of it as a cost they no longer have to incur. They're not worried about the downstream effects that we've been discussing. So they're basically saying to ICANN, just tell us what to do. They do have contracts with ICANN, and the contract obligates them to collect the Whois, even if they put it behind a privacy screen of some sort. So there's some of them that will choose on May 25th when the GDPR goes into effect to just stop collecting the information. The question then is, are they in breach of their contract with ICANN? I believe they will be, unless ICANN's got a big thing of liquid paper they're going to get out and start taking that out. But there's a process. ICANN's very process-oriented. You're not allowed to do policy development on the fly. They're doing it pretty quickly right now, trying to remedy this. But that is going to be a challenge that they're being very thoughtful about it, but they are very time-compressed as to how this is going to go forward.
Tim, any other unintended consequences you didn't mention?
I think I've done a good job talking about consequences. Let me talk about solutions. So Shane is absolutely right. I think there is goodwill to try and find I think there's an appreciation that security matters. I don't think anyone's saying it's all about privacy and everything else just doesn't count. The challenge is that time is upon us. May 25th is when GDPR takes its enforcement date. The good news is there is already a process in effect at ICANN called the Registry Directory Service. So there's a policy development process that's meant to redesign Whois to be a solution that can be compliant with privacy laws worldwide, but still protect and respect the reason that Whois has always existed for the last 25 years, almost without issue. And my hope is that that policy development process can be accelerated. If that's the case, I think and I hope that thoughtful people will come up with a balance of these two equities of privacy and security as it intersects Whois. But in the meantime, you know, so that's going to take over a year and possibly longer. So, you know, what happens in the middle, I'd prefer that we don't have a balkanization of the Whois data set, because that makes the job of people, I hope we can all agree, are doing things that matter in law enforcement and cybersecurity, trying to protect all of us as individual internet citizens. I hope there's a solution that ICANN can broker that allows some middle ground, some way forward in this interim period until the longer term policy development process can happen. And, you know, we stand by to help that however we can. And part of it is socializing this issue so people understand it.
There are other alternatives right now if somebody really wants to hide. As Tim mentioned, you have the country codes, and some of them do not make their information completely public. So there, it'll become a race to the bottom very quickly as to where can you be the Barbary Coast of where you hide. It's kind of the pirates of the internet. That's been going on for a while, but we've been able to isolate that. My concern is always that the internet was built on trust, which freaks lawyers out, but it's true. Technical people just knew each other, and then it was built from there. And there is a level of innate trust that takes place on the internet. And so there's multiple tiers of things that can break here besides the Whois. It's the way that we currently, you know, process internet transactions and knowing who we can value and trust on the internet. Two-factor authentication, and there's other ways to kind of manage through that. But on the larger scale, we want to know who we're dealing with. And just a personal example was I was watching the Olympics. Okay, so I was watching the Winter Olympics, and Facebook noticed that and threw up an ad for Marmont jackets that seemed exceptionally affordable. So knowing how the Whois works, I jumped on the Whois to see where they were based. And it was a non-US based, it did have a .com address, but they were not based in the United States. So that told me as a consumer that if I were to buy this, you know, $200 jacket, that's probably worth more than that, or if it was real, I would have no recourse. I would get the jacket, may show up, may not show up. And then, what we're used to as a consumer is having levels of somebody that can interfere on my behalf will be completely gone.
Any final thoughts?
Be optimistic. I like to be optimistic because I've been very deep in this issue. It's vexing. I understand why it's a complex issue. We want to defend the right to privacy of internet citizens worldwide, but at the same time, there needs to be some, and this is just my personal opinion, there needs to be some level of accountability on the internet. And if we have what becomes just an anonymous network, because this is really our network, right? There's no terms of use of the internet. You can just go register a domain name and do whatever you want with it. And if there's no accountability there, then I worry that it goes the way of other anonymous networks that I think we've all studied to some extent. And if you look at Tor, which has some very useful purposes, but also can be a magnet for some very bad things on the dark web in general, Bitcoin, which is an anonymous currency, and I'm sure it has some real value. I'm not an expert there, but I also know that all of the bad guys are using Bitcoin because you can't trace it. And that removes law enforcement's ability to follow the money, which is one of the ways that they capture, or at least stop the bad guys and have for generations. It's just gone because you have this untraceable anonymous currency process called Bitcoin. And so if the internet becomes that, people can do what they want, nobody knows who you are, I'm concerned that it creates some, it feeds the badness and doesn't help defend all of the goodness that we've enjoyed on the internet for so many years. And that's something that I think is worth fighting for. And it's why we make time for things like this, which we appreciate you giving us a platform to say those things. So thank you.
I think to liken it to an issue near and dear to your heart, Section 230. People have thought of the internet since it's U.S. based as having the First Amendment right built into it. Protection of, you know, people's ability to use the internet has just always been there, and that the American government was in the background and would defend against anybody trying to do something that was not in the best interest of the internet citizens. I know this is not the reason that they're doing GDPR, but it is showing a pathway on how to misbehave and break things. And there's a lot of countries that will take this example, and they've now seen how they are able to tie this one small issue in knots, and that starts to escalate. I'm just going to start buying books. I just think that they're going to have to do something else to entertain myself if this keeps going down this path.
It was a pleasure having you too. Thank you for breaking down such a complicated issue for us. And we're going to link to Shane's work and your white papers on the issue in the show notes so our listeners can educate themselves more. And hopefully we'll have you guys back on the podcast after we have some clarity on the consequences and the future that we just talked about. You can follow Tech Freedom on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom, and please leave us a review so others can find the show and our previous host can tell how great we're doing. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Ash.
Thank you.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.